You're listening to Midori House, a first broadcast on the 20th of February 2017 on Monocle 24. Live from London, this is Midori House on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
You look at what's happening last night in Sweden. Sweden. Who would believe this? Sweden. They took in large numbers. They're having problems like they never thought possible.
What was Donald Trump's confusing Swedish gaffe all about? We'll consider some of the facts that might have been eluding the president. Meanwhile, in Munich...
With regard to Ukraine, we must hold Russian accountable and demand that they honor the Minsk agreements, beginning by de-escalating the violence in eastern Ukraine.
The vice president maintains America's position on Ukraine, but a proposed peace plan supported by Trump insiders might suggest otherwise. We'll also consider the real cost of economic sanctions on Russia's struggling citizens. And a little later...
Well, what happened is we were shooting the pilot just before, during, and after the election. And the pilot was written on the supposition we would have a female president. And
I know the feeling.
A new spin-off to the CBS drama The Good Wife is one of several series altering their plans as America feels a cultural shift. That is all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are the columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, Mary Dajewski, and Michael Goldfarb, veteran journalist and broadcaster. Good friends both. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us. Now, contrary to some rather confusing remarks by the US president, a rally in Florida on Saturday, Sweden isn't in the aftermath of a great tragedy. After appearing to react to what he termed as what's happening in Sweden last night, Trump clarified, saying he was actually referring to this report on Fox News concerning Swedish immigration.
Perhaps no nation on earth is more committed to accepting foreign migrants and refugees than Sweden. 2016 alone, the country accepted more than 160,000 asylum seekers, despite having a population of less than 10 million people. Only 500 of these migrants were able to get jobs in Sweden. But if these arrivals aren't able to work, they're at least able to commit crimes.
That broadcast continued with host Tucker Carlson interviewing the filmmaker Amy Horowitz, who claimed that increased numbers of migrants arriving in Sweden have led to rising crime statistics, according to the Swedish Institute. However, the report contained many inaccuracies and failed to note that, in fact, the rate of crime in Sweden, by their measures, is declining. Mary Dajewski, it's, again, we heard Trump talking about Sweden and we emit a chuckle. He's tried to qualify it and say he's making a different point, and we'll come on to the status of Sweden in a moment. What did you make of his remarks, though? First of all, is it just further evidence of someone who's not really in control of his communications?
Well, I think the worrying thing about it is that he took a report on Fox News, which, you know, it may have been entirely accurate. And, you know, let's say it was more accurate than not. But the idea that a prime source of information for the President of the United States is the program he saw on Fox News a few hours before, you know, I don't think that reflects terribly well. Or if it does, then probably the whole of the information sort of backup that any White House has at its disposal basically could be done away with, because it must be hugely expensive, lots of expertise, and you've got a president who basically doesn't use it.
I mean, Michael Mary is right, isn't he? Isn't she? This is the issue. Trump's branded certain elements of the media as the enemy today, but he seems to be his opinions are informed by the last thing that he watched on mainstream television, and that cannot be a good thing.
Well, it can't be a good thing in any respect, but this is actually, he's been in this place for quite a while. I think that people trying to understand why he managed to get elected in the first place, even though he had 3 million fewer votes, getting past the U.S. constitutional question, is there is, you know, this divide in American media consumption that is so stark that you have to have experienced it. I'm going to assume that a lot of Monocle listeners have visited the United States, have worked in the United States, and probably have an idea of what I'm talking about. But what we heard, that little extract on Fox, coming, you know, I mean, wherein you bring someone like Amy Horowitz, who is, you know, some extreme right-wing person who, an Islamophobe, and he's goes out and he makes what he calls documentaries that basically make his point. I mean, he's a polemicist against Muslims. And so you have him on and you say, well, but this is news. The other side won't tell you this. And here we have these things going on just the other night in Sweden. And in fact, I mean, if there's been any real deadly violence in Sweden in the last 18 months, it's been neo-Nazis breaking into a school and killing a teacher and two young immigrant kids who were trying to get an education, learn Swedish. But it is not isolated. Tens of millions of people consider Fox to be a reliable source of information. The Christian Broadcasting Network, a reliable source of information. Breitbart, whose former publisher is now the top advisor to Donald Trump, has enormous traffic now online. And it isn't people, you know, going to have a laugh or people going to get conspiracy theories. They actually think that's the news. These are the facts. The liberals won't tell us the facts because they don't want to offend Muslims. And it's a shocking state of affairs and a dangerous one.
Mary, I guess one of the other dangers here is that then even beyond those elements that Michael's describing there, there's a demographic who, I don't know, maybe seek to try and justify the post-rationalizing that Trump does. It's funny, I was just looking in at February's Monocle magazine and there was an interview with the mayor of Stockholm that we had. And she actually talks about the fact that actually there are some issues there. They're to do with Sweden's, you know, failed effort to engage with multiculturalism, which has been happening since the 70s, and it's been put under strain. And actually, crime in the city is quite pronounced in areas that have, you know, migrant populations. Is one of the problems here that, as well as that demographic that Michael's talking about, who are consuming this news media so enthusiastically, then the sort of middle ground, if you like, start to look at, say, that information and say, oh, well, maybe there is a truth here. And that's when it becomes even more dangerous.
Well, I'm not sure that I think the problem is that because of the way that Donald Trump reacted and the fact that he's president of the United States, this puts everything in a completely different sort of category and elevates it out of all proportion to even to the story on Fox News. And when you have the mayor of Stockholm, you know, I remember whenever it was about 2 years ago and there were riots in Malmö. And this was quite shocking to me because probably like most people, maybe like Donald Trump, you assume that Sweden is this sort of model of enlightenment and everybody lives happily side by side and they have taken in a lot of refugees and migrants and they seem to have very expert integration programs and they've probably made as good a success of it as anywhere. But I have to say, you know, I was in Stockholm most recently, maybe about 18 months ago, and certainly it was, you know, there were more homeless people around on the streets, more people begging, which I think is now being made a crime in parts of Sweden. And there was evidence of social problems that, say, 10 years ago there wouldn't have been.
Well, I think that we have to remember that we all think of Sweden. Sweden's been very successful in putting itself forward in the world as a place where everything kind of works, where social democracy has achieved its greatest successes and everybody has sex whenever they want to and all of that stuff. But we also have to remember that the murder rate in Ystad, where Inspector Kurt Wallander plies his trade, is the highest per capita on the face of the earth, even worse than Guatemala and El Salvador, if I'm only half joking. And the girl, and you know, the trilogy that starts with the girl with the dragon tattoo. I think that underneath that, there obviously are social problems in Sweden that, you know, probably swept under the rug as much as possible. But in this case, the experiments of taking in, you know, 10 million people and you take in 150,000 refugees overnight, that is a significant number. Mm. I mean, extrapolate that over to 310 million which is the population of the United States, and what would that number be? I mean,
but should there be then? Should there be, Michael, then a more grown-up conversation, a more frank, more honest conversation about the problems that that causes? Is one of the issues that if there is a tendency to brush under the carpet, that maybe provides a vacuum where people who are trying to peddle, you know, mis or disinformation can operate.
Well, listen, they've been doing this for a long time. Now, look, who's the most famous Swede at the moment? Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Now, that's not a Swedish name. We know that. He came from Bosnia. He came from the Balkans, you know, whenever. I don't know how old he was when he moved there, or his family moved. Second generation, whether in Sweden or in the United States, of immigrants, particularly those who come in circumstances where they aren't necessarily welcomed with open arms, often have big problems because, one, they don't get integrated super quickly. They may not get the best education. They tend to find themselves having to fight because they have no real identity. And so they form gangs. It's the same thing in America where, you know, the worst gang violence in the Hispanic community in L.A. came, you know, in the 80s and 90s with second-generation kids, kids who had actually been born in America but weren't welcomed as Americans in the wider population, weren't really accepted as Mexicans back in Mexico when they went home to see their grandparents, and so had identity problems. And yes, there have been problems in Malmo, but nothing on the scale that was being explained on Fox News and that was half listened to by Donald Trump as he was changing out of his golf togs and putting on his blazer to make his entrance into the palace at Mar-a-Lago to the cheers and applause of people who pay $200,000 a year to be members there.
Indeed, and perhaps half listened
is the key thing. This sort of degree of ignorance, or it appeared to do, because Trump sort of put it in the same box as, say, Brussels and Paris and other things, which is why everybody jumped to the conclusion that something had happened in Sweden that actually hadn't happened in Sweden. These were completely different things, different categories of things, and yet they were all lumped together.
And I just wonder, you know, is there a demographic then in Europe? I mean, we talked before in this programme, Sean Mary, about the, you know, a pivot to the right, or, you know, the opportunity that opens for people with a populist agenda. If you look at other countries, certainly we in the UK would regard as bastions of progressive Western liberalism, like Sweden, like, I don't know, the Netherlands or Germany even, you know, you see these similar discussions, and maybe they are resting, though, with an issue about how to acknowledge the problems with their very socially admirable policies. Does that present an opportunity to Geert Wilders or Alternative for Deutschland or whoever it might be?
Well, I mean, I think that's absolutely entirely true. But I think it's also a reflection of the fact that maybe, you know, even somebody like me, you know, follow current affairs, and still at the back of your mind, you have this image of Sweden as being essentially Swedish and stuck in a sort of liberal, left-wing, socially organised type of country. Which actually it's not been for a very long time. I mean, it's had conservative governments. It's now got the Sweden Democrats as a right-wing force in Sweden. You know, as Trump might say, Sweden, for God's sake.
Let's move on and turn our attention to Russia now. Economic sanctions designed to curb Vladimir Putin's purported aspirations of world disruption, if not domination, have perhaps not been quite as effective as many had hoped. But for many Russians, particularly those outside the bigger urban areas, the impact has been markedly worse after 2 years of recession and what many say is a doubling of food prices. Many statistics show the average Russian consumes less meat, fish and dairy products. About half grow at least some of their own fruit and vegetables. Some have also resorted to buying cheap variants, vodka substitutes, for example, which has led to cases of mass alcohol poisoning, which we've seen. Putin, Mary, may be enjoying, well, I don't know if it's a publicity boost around the world. People certainly admire his opportunism. What about this homegrown economic gloom? Is that the sort of thing that could catch up with him, even amongst his most ardent following within his own borders?
Well, I think I would sort of say two completely different things in respect of this. One of them is that I think the extent to which increased prices and shortages of certain imported goods, largely, is a result of sanctions, I think is probably hugely exaggerated, because it's far more likely to be the result of much lower oil prices, which has had a far greater effect on the Russian economy than anything to do with Western sanctions. Western sanctions, the effect has been quite narrowly limited to imported foodstuffs. And it's also had an almost reverse effect. I was talking to somebody about 6 months ago who came from one of the biggest agricultural areas in southern Russia. And he said that those sort of areas were experiencing a fantastic boom because there was a lot of import substitution going on. An enormous amount of investment had been directed to those sort of things. So I think the extent to which this is a result of sanctions can be exaggerated. But the second thing I would say is that in some respects it suits officials, including maybe Putin, to blame economic difficulties on the West, because that encourages a sort of national morale and blaming foreigners and the West, which makes the makes Putin and the members of his team more popular than they already are. But you have to be very, very careful with that, because Putin's popularity, which is still very, very high compared with leaders in most countries around the world, his popularity has to a large extent been built on the restoration of stability, law and order, and a strong economy. And if that economy starts being felt to be weak by too many people, then I think Putin's popularity could go down very, very fast.
Well, I mean, and that's the rub, isn't it, Michael? You know, if we look at the data, the economy shrank, the Russian economy shrank by, what, 3.7% in 2015, deep into recession, one of the sort of 10 worst performing, you know, of the emerging market nations. How do you think Putin is faring and will fare, and how's he going to strike that balance which Mary mentions there between styling himself as turning his face against the world, but he's nevertheless presiding over an economy that's, you know, really contracting?
Well, Vladimir Putin is not the first strongman leader. He's a dictator. The first dictator to cotton on to the fact that if you project the nation you lead as being strong abroad, the people will forgive you and enormous amount. And, you know, the decline in living standards, in life expectancy in Russia has been, I think, one of the most important keys to understanding, because he's more or less been running the country for more than a decade. And you look and see these declining standards. No one has turned on him yet. There's been infighting amongst former members of his inner circle. You know, some of the oligarchs have fallen afoul of him. But the people themselves seem perfectly content. And there is an interesting parallelism, on just bringing up life expectancy. In the middle of last year, some statistics came out in America, finally, that life expectancy amongst the white working class in America had actually gone backwards, which, I mean, every other demographic group has seen, as all over the developed world, I mean, people are living longer, except amongst the white working class. And suddenly there's Trump surfing along, saying, I'm going to make America great again, you know, and no matter how foolish it is, and I'm sure that somewhere people who watch Fox News, even if they're self-propagandized, self-brainwashed, know that there's illogic in what he says. They don't care. He's going to make their country great again. Vladimir Putin says, I will make Russia great again. He proves it. He rolls into eastern Ukraine, western Russia, you know, retakes Crimea. And people will forgive an awful lot, and particularly Russians will forgive an awful lot, because I hate to indulge in national stereotypes, but suffering is an essential part of being Russian. People say, we can take it. We took Hitler. We took Stalin. What? We can't get imported foodstuffs? Excuse me. This is no reason to turn on a strong leader.
Well, we'll be alighting in Ukraine next for more on that. We're also going to be talking about how writers are reshaping scripted TV in Trump's America. We'll continue with Michael Goldfarb and Mary Dzhevsky after this.
Whether you're thinking of founding your own nation or would like to make the one you live in a bit better, we have the book for you. The brand new How to Make a Nation, A Monocle Guide, is an informed and quietly provocative book about updating the art of statecraft. After 10 years of meeting inspiring citizens and on-it PMs, soft power influencers and smart architects, we'll tell you how to construct the perfect embassy, design a modern parliament, and even how to make the most of your national dress. This 340-page large format book delivers fresh thinking and lots of solutions too. It's a book about the small things that can make our nations work better for everyone that calls them home. Buy your copy today at monocle.com and all good bookstores. Go on, be the leader.
This is Midori House, live from London. I'm Tom Edwards. Still with me, Mary Dzhevsky and Michael Goldfarb. At a security conference in Munich on Friday, Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko warned against any efforts to appease Russia in the face of continued encroachment in the nation's east. But a document being circulated amongst a group of Trump insiders contains what some are calling a plan for peace in Ukraine. Many claim the Ukrainian politician behind the plan is styling himself as the country's own Donald Trump, Trump fueling his political ambitions while suggesting Crimea could be leased to Russia. But while the current White House might be tempted to consider the plan, how different, one wonders, would the discussion be if Russia were not encroaching upon Ukraine, but I don't know, Mary, Alaska or some such place. What do you make of that slightly playful premise?
I'm deeply offended because very soon after Crimea happened, I proposed that one way of getting around this would be for a lease arrangement a la Hong Kong or Gibraltar, or a sales arrangement as with Alaska or the Louisiana Purchase.
So they were listening.
So, well, it's taken them a long time. It's taken them far too long. I mean, I don't think that would actually be acceptable. I don't think it would be acceptable to Ukrainians in Kiev. I don't think it would necessarily be acceptable to the Russians unless they were feeling in a particularly sort of concession-granting mood. What I do think is that there's a lot of positioning going on. There's a lot of positioning going on from Kiev, as we saw from Poroshenko in Munich, from Russia, from the Kremlin, and from the United States. And it's very, very difficult to figure out what's going on. But about 3 weeks to a month ago, there was indeed suggestions among certain oligarchs in Ukraine that they might be prepared to give up Crimea under whatever guise, in return for a hard border in the east, an end to such Russian interference as may or may not be going on in the east, and a acceptance of Ukraine within its current borders minus Crimea. Now, the particular oligarch who proposed that got into huge amounts of trouble. There was a lot of criticism, a lot of infighting following. But the fact that this was being mooted inside Ukraine by Ukrainians with influence suggested that this was indeed something that went beyond Ukraine and could at least form a sort of a paper for discussion.
It's interesting. You're talking about Ukraine, Russia, and I'm still not sure what the White House point of view is. I don't think the White House does. Mike Pence was just, you know, we just heard him at the start of the program saying the Minsk agreement, you have to, we've signed this, we stand by it. Meanwhile, you know, while Pence is in Europe soothing the allies, meanwhile, back in America, at Mar-a-Lago still, I think, you know, the president and his boys are talking about accepting a fait accompli. And, you know, what would work for Putin primarily? And, you know, they've got to sort it out in Washington and have a very specific idea of what the policy is. It seems to me that unless the Ukrainian government and the Russian government, between the two of them, can come up with a solution, as Mary suggests, which doesn't seem likely, then the Minsk agreement is what's on the table. Mm. And that seems to keep the situation in aspic, except that we have this collection of contacts between the Trump inner circle and the Russian government that we don't know about. And we don't know what commitments were given in advance of the election. I mean, there may be none. That's the point. There may be absolutely no contacts at all or discussion about Ukraine, except in those general sense. But on the other hand, Paul Manafort, who briefly was Trump's campaign manager, used to be running, you know, press and PR for Viktor Yanukovych, who was Putin's man in Ukraine. It's all very confusing.
And I guess the only thing safe to say before we move on, Mary, is that whatever solution is arrived at, it's almost safe to say that we probably won't have all of the relevant stakeholders engaged or involved or on board with whatever that decision looks like.
Yes, I think it's going to be extremely difficult because, Ukraine is still divided country. And the problem is that, if you like, the main dividing line between what used to be Western, Eastern Ukraine, it's now moved so far to the east that it's just the two what we call rebel eastern regions that are out on a limb. But the demands from Kiev and points west will be absolutist, and it'll be very difficult to find a compromise acceptable, especially after people have actually resorted to arms. That just makes things much more complicated.
Well, here's a question for you. Who wouldn't want to turn back the clock and relive the 2016 presidential election once again? If that suggestion fills you with about as much excitement as a visit to the dentist, you might like to avoid a couple of new TV series coming soon. According to American Horror Story creator Ryan Murphy, the next installment of that series will be about the election, in addition to other election-themed drama series in the works from the team behind the films Zero Dark Thirty and The Hurt Locker. Meanwhile, Fox, CBS, NBC are planning more military-themed series, while ABC's entertainment president admitted the network might have too many programmes depicting well-to-do, well-educated people driving nice cars and living in extremely nice places. Michael, it is quite interesting, isn't it? We talk about the news media targeting or maybe missing relevant demographics altogether. Scripted drama, I guess, almost necessarily falls into the same trap, doesn't it? You know, a lot of the drama on the slate for 2017 is Obama's America on the small screen.
Well, yeah, and what's interesting is how television production schedules have been pushed to the limit to reflect the news of the day. Networks have to have that gimmick because they're getting creamed by HBO on serious long-running dramas. I mean, whether spectacles like Game of Thrones or, you know, adult dramas like The Affair. Look, ABC can't compete with that. So what they've got is, you know, they're going to do The Good Wife, except it's going to be Christine Baranski, who was her partner. And it was supposed to be she was going to be serving in a Clinton-like figure's administration. So there is no Clinton administration. So now they've had to completely rewrite the season. And I think it's really quite difficult. And as for, you know, showing this demographic that seems to have been ignored in recent years, I mean, I'm so old, Tom. I'm so much older than you.
Surely not,
Michael. When I left America, sitcoms were all based in the white working class, whether it was All in the Family, a long-running, enormously popular sitcom, which made Norman Lear, the producer and writer, phenomenally rich, and he's an extraordinary liberal. And in fact, the number of liberal NGOs in America that are funded through Norman Lear's fortune is really quite extraordinary. And there was Roseanne with Roseanne Barr and John Goodman. You know, and this was in Reagan's America, but somewhere along the line, people, that whole part of society was left behind, except in the zombie series. And the zombie series, that's where you see the trailer park types, and also in the ones about opioid addiction. But, you know, in the ground series, the aspirational series, you don't see those people. So maybe it would be good if we saw some.
I'm looking forward to West Wing crossed with Dallas.
Is that is what's happening in reality, isn't it? I'm getting confused. But just on that point, would you tune in? I don't know. Are we going to see, do you think we will genuinely see, you know, these sort of military series and patriotic flag fluttering stuff? I mean, and does it matter if we do for a short time?
Well, I think that, there's so many variants on this. I mean, we could go right back to cowboys and Indians, except you're not allowed to talk about either now, I think, under PC rules. But I think the idea that we'd be going even to something like Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Forty, I mean, these are so gritty, pessimistic sort of things. Somehow I don't think they quite fit with the Trump days.
There, we might have to leave it. Mary Dejewski and Michael Goldfarb, thank you both very much indeed for being our guests today. On Midori House, today's programme was produced by Ben Ryland. Thanks to him and all the team, including Toby, behind the glass. This is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800. Do join us then. Goodbye.